Could you first tell me, Mr. Letterman, where and when you were born?
I was born in London, 1929.
Yes. And what did your parents do?
My father was a half-commission man on the Stock Exchange for a period of years, up until the war. And then we were evacuated and he set up a small jewellery business in Birmingham.
Mm. Can you explain what a half-commission man was?
Yes. It was, in those days, where individuals had their own clients.
Yes.
And they weren't principals of the firm or partners, as they were. And they received literally half the commission that was taken. And that was a system that was operative for quite a long time.
Mm. And he was working for a broking firm?
Yes, a small broking firm.
Was there any particular reason why he decided to leave?
He had mixed fortunes, I think. He was quite a gambler. And he did very well two or three times, and then things didn't go quite as well. And then because of the evacuation, he decided that he ought to do something a little bit more constructive and positive.
Where did he send you to school?
We went to a boarding school in Wales called Whittingham College, and I had a very enjoyable time there. Unfortunately, he died at a fairly early age. He died at the age of 51 while I was still at school. And my mother was left on her own with three fairly unpleasant youngsters to bring up, I think.
So, and what did you do when you finished school?
I went to a technical college in Birmingham. I took a sort of secretarial course, which I was pretty hopeless. And I think it was my intention at the time to, well, try and spend as much time as I could in the sporting field. Mm. And I used to get up to the county cricket ground as often as I possibly could.
Mm. And did you start that course with a view to any particular career?
No, I think it was basically to keep myself out of trouble until I went to do national service, which was looming ahead.
And that's what you went on to next?
That's right. I went into the army in 1947. Mm. And the period of enlistment then was for 18 months, but due to some of the problems in Palestine and elsewhere, it was extended, and I did virtually 2 years.
Mm. And at the end of that 2 years, what happened?
Well, I came out, and I had a little leave due to me. And I think in those days, I thought the world owed me a little bit of a living. And I didn't do too much for a couple of months. And then I think I began to get a little bit of ashamed of myself because my mother was working. And I eventually signed on at the local labour exchange in the city, in Moorgate, and got a job with an Australian import-export firm, which lasted for about 18 months. It was extraordinarily boring and very underpaid. And I eventually confided in my mother that I'd had enough of this. And by chance, she said, well, I happen to know of somebody to whom we were very vaguely related who might just possibly want young men in their office. Mm. And so it transpired.
And who did you transfer to? You moved.
She spoke to Mr. Charlie Smith, mm. who was one of the original Smith brothers. Mm. And after an interview, they took me on for an office job.
Mm. And so this was the jobbing firm Smith Brothers?
This was the jobbing firm Smith Brothers.
And when was this?
This was in 1951.
Mm. Now, could you tell me something about the firm at that time, when you joined?
Yes, it was a very small firm. I think they had six partners, four of whom had come back from the war. Mm. And Charlie Smith, as I said, one of the founders, was on the fringe of retiring or taking it easily. Mm. And the four partners who came back from the war wanted to move on a little bit. It was basically a Jewish-orientated firm, although not entirely so. And they dealt in some of the industrial equity stocks and the gold mining stocks, the South African gold mining stocks, which is one of their strengths.
How long had the firm been in existence, roughly?
Started in 1923, so approximately 38 years when I joined.
Mm-hmm. And what was the first job that you had in the firm?
Clerking in the office.
Mm. What did that involve?
Or ticking off ledgers, entering up bargains, and then you progress to the exalted status of checking clerk, which meant you went downstairs and into a room underneath the stock exchange and checked bargains with the various brokers that you dealt with during the day, and hopefully matched everything up.
Mm. What can you tell me something about the actual size of the office when you started, about how many people were employed?
I think there were about a dozen. Mm. The office itself was pretty scrappy in Warnford Court, third floor of Warnford Court, and I think I was the youngest there by a very considerable number of years. Mm. And the turnover was fairly high because as they took on a youngster, somebody usually left for a variety of reasons. And, they weren't notoriously good payers. And, so it went on from there. And
can you remember roughly what your first wage was?
I think it was just over £5 a week. I think I got £5.02 at the original company I was at, Gollin and Company, it's Australian, and I think I improved a tiny bit on that. So somewhere around about the £5.10 as it was then, £6 mark.
And how was the office actually organised physically? Did all the staff occupy one room and the partners have separate rooms?
There was a partner's room. The partners were all trading in those days. There was no such thing as analytical partners, or certainly not from our point of view there wasn't. All the partners used to go down to the stock exchange at 9:30 and come up to their own room at 3:30 and take out their profit and loss. And the rest of the office was dispersed amongst 4 or 5 rooms.
Can you remember anything about the partners at this time as individuals?
Yes. The senior partner was a very, very kind man, Mr. Ranson, who actually employed me and went on to become an honorary market official later in his career. He spoke at a tremendous rate of knots, and I found it very difficult to understand exactly what he was saying. And he used to give instructions in this rapid-fire voice and expect you to understand immediately what he was saying. And until I'd caught up with the lingo of the stock exchange, I did have trouble with this. And the second senior partner was a man by the name of Sidney King, who had a sort of slightly notorious reputation in the stock exchange, but I was eventually apprenticed to him to stand with him as my first trading job, and he taught me a hell of a lot of what I did come to know. And the other two partners, Sidney Davis and Henry Marks, were experts in the South African gold mining market, and they, perhaps I shouldn't be so irreverent, became to be known because of their short stature as Tweedledum and Tweedledee. And those four basically drove the firm along from the early 1950s.
Mm. Had they always been with the firm?
Yes. Mm. Yes, they'd all started with Smith Brothers from a very early age.
Mm. Was there any particular reason why the firm actually was working in the South African market?
Not to the best of my knowledge. They'd always traded South African shares. I presume because they thought it was a profitable place to have a go at. We didn't have any particular South African connections.
Well, let's return to you again. You started as a clerk in the office. You moved on to being a checking clerk. What was the next stage?
Well, the next stage was to become a blue button.
Can you explain what a blue button was?
A blue button was, in effect, a runner in the stock exchange. And the idea was to, for him to try and learn what was going on, and eventually, if he had any talent, to run a book. You wear then a general dog's body at the beck and call of all the partners. You ran limits, what we call limits, bidding and offering the brokers when they'd indicated they wanted certain prices for certain stocks, and generally trying to learn at the shoulder of the partner what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any particular memories of that time?
Well, yes, there's one rather amusing incident, I think, when I was in the gold market, and there was a shout from Mr. Marks. He called my name across, and my job was to keep the boards up to date, the price boards up to date. And there was this shout for me, and in the meantime, he'd looked somewhere else, and he called again, Lederman. And I said, yes, sir, and turned round and hit him smack in the eye with my elbow. It wasn't the best way to get on, but he took it in good heart, and I survived that one. And there was one other occasion when I was sort of called into the office, and the other gold mining partner, Sidney Davis, was leaning back in his chair and close to the door, and I sort of knocked on the door and went in rather quickly, and I sort of smacked the door into the back of his head, and however, I survived that one as well.
And how long were you a blue button?
I was a blue button for about 2.5 years. Mm. There was a minimum period of 2 years, I think it was. And
who was that specified by?
The Stock Exchange period? Council.
I see. And then?
Then I was authorised, which meant you were entitled to deal, but you were not a member. And due to the dismissal of one of the chaps in our firm, he had this temerity to turn up one day for work in an Edwardian-type suit. And in those days, that sort of thing didn't go down terribly well. Anyway, he was asked to leave, and I became an authorised clerk. And became a member in 1954.
Was this before you actually became a partner in the firm?
Yes.
Yes. And what were you doing as an authorised clerk?
Holding a very small book which contained a relatively few stocks of insignificant nature, really, not the leader stocks. And basically, when your partner went out to lunch or whatever, you took over the lead book and hope to keep out of trouble. And,
How did you find this when you started? Was it a bit nerve-wracking?
It was a little bit nerve-wracking, but somehow or other, I don't think I felt too nervous about changing the prices if I thought it was right. And I had a very good teacher in the aforesaid Sidney King, who was a ruthless type of jobber, had no compunction in calling prices up or down to try and sort his book out if he thought it was necessary. And
you'd simply learnt through experience by being with this man.
Yes.
What could you say about the stock exchange generally at this period? For example, you referred to one of your colleagues being sacked because he hadn't maintained the correct dress standard.
Well, it was very formal, much more formal. When I went down to the house for the first time as a blue button, you wore a stiff collar and a tie of somber hue. And if you sort of transgressed these things, it was somewhat frowned upon. And it took a long, long time to become more modern, more up to date. And the partners of those days were, like little gods. And everybody was, yes, sir, and no, sir. And if you didn't conform, you left.
Yes.
And labour was fairly plentiful. Mm-hmm. So it was a question of being polite and courteous, and I agreed with it, honestly.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about the stock exchange generally? Did it feel like an institution that had not changed for a long time?
Yes. The traditions soon got to you, the things that you could do and shouldn't do, and there were one or two rituals that were carried on.
Did you refer to any of those, for example?
Round about 3:15 on a Friday afternoon, several members of the old Gilt Market used to sing, and I'm not quite sure why, Jerusalem. I think it was something to do with one of the characters in the Gilt Edge Market, which was at the far end of the Stock Exchange from where I was, but this was one of those little things that happened without fail on a Friday afternoon.
Could you describe physically what the floor of the Stock Exchange was like?
Yes. I can't quite give you the exact
no.
area of it, but there were several pillars which were, we called stands, numbered stands, where the old waiters, mostly ex-army people, called out the names of members who were needed for business or messages to pass on. And I think there were 14 of those, plus a number of little sort of tubs, we used to call them, where you could sort of sit down and sit around, although Blue Buttons, of course, weren't allowed to sit down.
That was one of the other conventions?
Oh, well, it was a rule. Blue Buttons did not sit down unless the partner had said, work this out for me and sit on the seat or whatever it may be. But you definitely did not sit down.
And then you had the different markets located in different points?
Yes, although they weren't totally defined, they sort of gravitated to various areas. One or two of them did extend a little bit beyond the main conclave, if you like. But you soon found out who was attached to each market. And there were some, I think, a lot of conventions to the South African gold market. I mean, one of the silly things they used to do was the South African gold market was covered by a big dome at one end of the Stock Exchange, and it used to be a regular competition to shoot paper darts up to the dome and sort of see if you could lodge them, and all these rather silly little things that did go on in those days, but it was great fun.
Mm. Could you describe a typical day for you at this stage as an authorised clerk? About what time would you come into work? Would you go straight to the office and so on?
As an authorised clerk, I used to go into the Stock Exchange at 9:30 when dealing started. In those days, they didn't open the doors to the jobbers specifically, as was introduced later, to allow them to get to their pitches and organise themselves, but there was a general rush to whatever your pitch was. And that went on with an interval for lunch and until 3:30 when the Stock Exchange closed. Mm. And then one returned to the office.
Mm. And did you normally take a break for lunch?
Yes. Mm. I remember again, perhaps just a little interesting story, that I got to know quite a few young people and a few sporting lads, I suppose one might call them, and we used to go down to the old ABC coffee bar, which was in Bournemouth Court. Mm. And I think we used to order about two rounds of toast between eight of us, and we all used to sit down there playing mini poker. Mm. And I extended my lunch hour by about 20 minutes one day and got the most almighty bollocking when I got back for having been far too involved. Mm. I don't think the partners knew quite what I was doing, but I was decidedly late and made well aware of it.
Were you generally quite busy when you were dealing on the floor?
Yes. There were a considerable number of smaller bargains. Mm. And the private investor, I think, was 60 or 70% of the market in those days. Mm. So there were quite a large number of small bargains, small investors. And we used to do several pages of business in stocks like Woolworths, Marks and Spencers, old Lewis's Investment Trust. So that was where I first started dealing in the stores market.
How did you actually know who were the principals in these transactions?
Well, again, that was one of the conventions in the stock exchange, that you never asked anybody which firm he was with. And it was definitely not done to inquire of anybody. And if necessary, if a partner of a broking firm came up to you and asked you a price and bought or sold a number of shares, and you didn't know who he was, you just said, "Thank you, sir," and sell you 1,000 at 2 and 9p. And you then followed the gentleman to, hopefully, to the stand and asked one of the waiters, who were the fount of all knowledge in those days, and they would tell you that Mr. So-and-so was with whoever it may have been.
Were there any particular characteristics of the markets you were dealing in during this early post-war period? I mean, were they booming? Were they generally quite healthy?
Well, again, I was lucky, I think, because Sidney King was in the stores market, was our partner in the stores market. Mm. And we managed to partake of the early 1950s and onwards stores boom. Mm. So there was quite a lot of business going on, and in those days the names were very popular. Mm. Debenhams, Lewis Investment Trust, as I said, Woolworths, Marks and Spencers. Mm. Gussie were just on the fizz. Wolfson was really sort of beginning to motor in those days. Great Universal Stores, Sears, Drages, and those sort of stocks. Mm. And they were very, very popular. And the press tips were quite frequent. And as the shares were relatively low priced, they had a big following. Mm. A lot of bargains were done, particularly on a Monday after the Sunday financial papers had a go at tipping certain shares.
Mm. Which particular market were you dealing in?
I was dealing in the stores market.
How were the other markets that the firm were dealing in doing?
The South African gold market went very, very quiet, and in those days, my very early days, I used to get a profit share on the book which I was working, and as the gold market went very, very quiet, this led to a change in the remuneration of the firm, because my great friend Tony Lewis, who became chairman, who had been at the firm longer than I had been, suddenly found himself not earning any money because he was working in the gold market. And I, having arrived considerably later, was earning more than he was. And this was obviously not fair.
Yes. What was his position at this time? Was he
a member dealer at the time. Mm. I first met Tony in 1951 and we've been friends ever since. Mm. He went on to become chairman of the company.
How was this particular problem resolved with you making a reasonably good living? And
well, we became sharers. There was a bonus pool that was distributed on the profits of the whole firm.
Mm-hmm. Let's think about again the firm at the time in general terms and compare it with other jobbing firms at the floor. Was there anything distinctive about Smith's?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. How did it compare in terms of size?
Oh, tiny. Tiny. Mm-hmm. I think we were sort of the, perhaps not quite the minnows, but there were some great names about, some tremendous firms in those days. Yes, in the gold market, the Lazarus Brothers, Lehman Brothers. In the gilt edge market, there was Wed, Francis and Praed. In the industrial market, there was Ricardo Isaacs and Bray, Blackwell, Haddo and Turner, Percy Duke, Durlacher, did I say? F&N Durlacher, and several others.
And did your partners have any plans to try and expand the firm?
I don't think we ever wrote out a game plan, as one tends to do these days, an objective. But no, I think they had sort of informal discussions, and we managed to improve. We were dealing in a considerable number of the ordinary UK industrial stocks. Wilfred Ranson, another partner, Archie Jessop, used to do those, and Sidney King in the stores. And 2 or 3 years after I'd been dealing, Sidney King said to me, would you like to deal in steel shares? And still stand on the stores pitch, but deal in steel shares. And I accepted. Stocks and shares to me are basically just counters. I mean, they're either buyers or sellers. I don't, as a trader, think it's particularly necessary to have a detailed knowledge of every company you deal in. Certain personalities do require that. Other personalities tend to go by the seat of their pants considerably more. And the steel market had an advantage in it, that it was very, very well spread out in the stock exchange. There was no particularly focal point. It went almost from one end of the stock exchange to the other. I think at the time there were 14 jobbers there, competing jobbers.
How did you go about then deciding on how to mark a share? What price to?
Well, you just took up the shares and said you were dealing from whatever it may be, the 1st of January, and you found out what the price of the shares roughly closed on the previous closing date, and you opened up on your feel of the market for that particular day, and so you went on. I mean, obviously you did a bit of pre-advertising and forewarning of people that you were going to deal in the stocks as from then, and you circularised all the brokers and also your opposition.
Well, returning to, again, jobbing in general terms, there were still many firms trading as jobbers.
Very many, yes.
Was there a shakeout taking place at this time?
I suppose slowly, yes, but not disastrously so. Some of the big names did go. Kitchen Baker Mason was one that folded. Paulie Shaw. I think Frisbury Brothers, which are a very, very well respected little firm. A tiny anecdote there which might amuse, that the two Frisbee brothers had seen very considerable war service, and the elder one, I believe, won the VC, and the younger one won the MC, and he was known forever after as the coward because he hadn't quite equaled the heights of his brother.
Were there any particular reasons why these firms ceased to trade?
Mainly because the senior partners wanted to retire and didn't have the obligation that one has to go on, and they wanted to take their money out when they thought fit. And I think, as I indicated earlier, it was the small nucleus of the senior partners who ran the outfits with rods of iron without very much obligation to anybody else.
Did you have any youth firms coming into existence at this time?
There must have been one or two, but not any that I can think of offhand that made a great impact on the stock exchange.
Did you have much personal contact with other jobbing firms during the course of your working day?
Yes, one was in touch with them because quite often you went up and bid or offered stock.
Can you explain a little bit about that?
Well, it might be that, for example, you had bought some, let's say, Woolworths at 32 shillings, and maybe within a quarter of an hour's time you'd heard they were 32 and threepence bid with one of your opposition. Well, if you could go and sell those Woolworths at 32 and threepence, it was a nice profit in a nice space of time, short space of time. I mean, there was the possibility, of course, that brokers would come up and buy the shares, but you could probably deal in a larger size with your opposition than you could with a stray broker who might be a buyer.
Were the actual mechanics of dealing with another jobber the same as they would have been if a broker had come up to deal?
Yes, again, you had to go up and express yourself extremely carefully with other jobbers. You could not just go up to a jobber and say, I am a seller of Woolworths at 32 and threepence. he was entitled to then turn round and say to you, well, I will buy 5 million shares. You were making him an open offer. Mm-hmm. And you had to phrase things extremely carefully. Mm-hmm. And some of these senior jobbers were very, very tough on this with the youngsters. Mm-hmm. If you put a word out of place, they stuck you to those bargains, and could be quite expensive, and you obviously weren't too popular with your own senior partner when you got back and reported that you'd sold far more than he intended to you to in the first place.
So once you had actually made an offer, but without specifying a size, you were bound to take the size,
yes,
suggested by the other jobber.
Yes, you had to specify it. Mm. And the same applied to the open bidding, which went on in several markets in those days. There used to be a lot of bidding and offering.
Can you name some of those markets?
Particularly in the oil market, again the South African gold market. Mm. But you had to say 6 5/8 bid, 10,000 free stake gadooled. Mm. If you went in and bid 6 5/8 openly, literally everybody who wanted to sell at 6 5/8 was entitled to say, they're yours, and you had to honour those bargains. So it was a good discipline.
Mm-hmm. And how did this actually happen? Were you all gathered around the jobbers' pitches?
Well, you just went into the open market and shouted out.
Mm-hmm. Was this quite disruptive?
It was quite exciting. Mm-hmm. It didn't happen